Welcome back to Art Smack. I'm your host, Matt, and Jerry's off this week. Don't worry, you'll be hearing plenty from Jerry, as we're going to share a recently recorded interview we both did with Chicago-based artist Caleb Yono. Caleb is a genderqueer artist who is one of the most talented contemporary artists that Jerry and I have ever come across. Caleb's story is one that I don't think is told often enough in art media. And we explored so many topics in the conversation, from Caleb's practice to her experiences in the traditional art world. And I can't wait for you guys to hear it. So stay tuned for that. But before we dive in to the interview, I'm going to fly solo here for a little bit. So stick with me. I wanted to share two news stories at the top of this episode that I feel are really important for our audience to wrap their head around and hear. One of them is directly related to the art world and a little on the gossip side, but the other one is more on the economic side that I think has a huge impact on how we think about art. Okay, so the first story I want to bring up is a study that was released by a company called Smart Asset, and they are a financial advisor that performed this study. What they did was they took a look at 76 U.S. cities, the big ones, and they tried to analyze what a $100,000 salary per year felt like after taxes and after the cost of living in those cities. So basically, you know, how far does a $100,000 salary go in America today? Now, I think decades ago, $100,000 salary was a remarkable income, but times have changed, obviously. And this study really highlighted it from a data perspective about what is going on. So the results, unsurprisingly, taking spot number 76, the worst, most unaffordable place to live was New York City. A $100,000 salary in New York is about a $35,000 salary after the cost of living. Right behind that is San Francisco at $36,000. And just a few spots below that is Los Angeles at $44,000. So why is this story important? Well, it highlights something that Jerry and I have been discussing on the podcast for a while now, which is the structural imbalance that continues to exist within the art world, where young contemporary artists who are trying to make it in the mainstream gallery art fair scene, they have to live in these major cities. They have to be there at the openings. They have to network. They have to have studio space in Bushwick or elsewhere. They have to have these locations to bring collectors in. But making $100,000 in a year outside of art is difficult, let alone through the sales of paintings, especially for young artists just starting out. And this highlights something that we've discussed and that we feel is a huge dynamic today in the art world. And there is no answer to it. I don't believe anytime soon that the art world will decentralize in the way that we all might hope, where artists can exist and live and create outside of the major cities as they build their art language and their practice. But this study really does hit the point home about what it means to be an artist today and have to live in these places. So the second story this week involves artist Tom Sachs. So as many of you guys heard, a few weeks ago, the New York Times did an article on the job posting on NYFA.org that went viral. It outlined a high-profile couple in the art world's need for a personal assistant. And I'll spare you the details, but some of the requests were, they read like a parody, and the pay was exorbitantly low. And right after that New York Times article came out, ArtNet confirmed that that couple was indeed Tom Sachs and his wife. But that's not the story of this week. The story of this week is a subsequent report that came out on Curbed.com. Curbed had been working, it's unclear, but it seems to be before this job posting that came out on NYFA, on a expose of the activities that have been occurring in Tom Sachs's studio. The article outlines the stories of former and current employees at Tom Sachs' studio, describing a pretty hostile work environment, from inappropriate comments and work hours and mind games and imagery and asks. I'm going to link the story in the bio, so please take a read, give it a look. But some of the accusations in here are pretty eye-opening. In the wake of this story on Curbs, Nike, which has had a long-standing partnership with Tom Sachs in collaborations of sneakers that are super popular, Nike has come out and said that they are really disturbed and investigating these reports. It remains to be seen whether they will be severing their ties to Tom Sachs. But nevertheless, it's a pretty fascinating and interesting story that's taking place in the life of this artist. So the takeaway for me, I do not know how this will end up. I can only speculate that perhaps the knives are out for Tom right now. I don't know that these stories are correlated, but it does seem to be very coincidental that back to back there are these pieces coming out about Tom. And I encourage everyone to, before they land on a judgment about this, whether or not Tom Sachs is a good guy, a great artist, do yourself a favor and read the reports and come to a conclusion based on the evidence that you read. Because these things are very nuanced and it's easy to fall into black and white patterns, but give this one a review. Okay. With that said, let's dive into the fun part. Here is Jerry Gagosian and I's interview with Chicago-based artist Caleb Yono. Hope you guys enjoy.
Hello, Caleb. We meet at long last. You're a very big fan here, Jerry Gagosian. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
It's really, really good to have you on the podcast. I have to confess to anyone who is here who may not be familiar with your work. On my private Instagram, I have been online stalking you for, I would say, at least 2 years. My best friend and I, we really love your work. And what's really funny is the Mean Girls line, "She can sit with us," always comes up. And every time he DMs me one of your works, which, by the way, you might be one of the most prolific artists I actually have ever, like, come in contact with in, like, contemporary art. He always says, like, "She can sit with us." Your work is so amazing, and what makes it so amazing is you're prolific, but you span so many different mediums. You're incredibly playful. There's a lot of humor, glamour, beauty, drama. Like, there's so many things going on in your work. There's a lot of other artists who I could reference it in your work, and I'm sure that'll come up in our conversation. But I feel like that kind of almost takes away from you, but like you as an artist, when like somebody comes out of the pulls out of the driveway by being like, let's start by talking about the other artists that I see referenced in your work. But like, yeah. Jesus Christ, you are so prolific. Like, I see like movements upon movements in your work. Like, I'm trying to figure out when I started following you. And actually, now that I'm looking, I can't even figure it out. Like, I don't even know when. And I feel like I've scrolled back like 3,000 photos and I'm not even at the bottom.
I know. I need to limit her a little
bit.
Yes. It looms over me that I'm kind of a little chaotic on Instagram. It's not as like, I just like post. It's all about me getting a little bit of dopamine so I can get through the day.
In the loosest way, non-art speaky way, like, tell us who you are. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, there's some things that maybe I'd like to say about myself, but maybe, okay, I think I could say these things. So I am pretty neurodivergent, and I know that's kind of like a buzzword right now in the world. I have a mental disorder called borderline personality disorder, and it really shapes the way I perceive and understand social interactions and relationships with myself, like the way I self-talk to myself. And it involves a lot of what's called like emotional pain. And everyone experiences emotional pain, but people with BPD have it all the time for really no reason. So making artwork for me started at an early age. I think when my symptoms started manifesting, I became interested in art around puberty because it really helped me sort of manifest what was going on internally. I was also really heavily connecting to like German expressionist artists and expressionists in general around that time. Like that's when I found Egon Schiele. So that is one major aspect of my life, and it's something I struggle with, but that art has sort of, and maybe that's why there's such a sense of, there's a prolific quality to my practice, because it really is about sort of vanquishing the demons a little bit when I make work. And that's why there's like sort of a fever pitch to it. I know that sounds like sort of, it's very cliche to be like, I'm an artist and I'm mentally ill. But it's like,
I'm sorry, I'm laughing with you and with myself, not at you.
You can laugh.
No, I'm. We'll get to know each other. Trust me, I'm laughing with you. Keep going.
So that's like a deep dive, and not something I would probably tell people right away when I'm meeting them. But if I'm engaging with someone in something like a collaborative project, or I do disclose that because people may experience some strange behavior from me in relationship to how I am dealing with them. So I think it's also affected my art world sort of relationships, especially here in Chicago. I've sort of like gotten a little crazy on people. So maybe Chicago doesn't like, that's not true. I'm not going to say that. I think Chicago really likes me in a lot of ways, and I get a lot of opportunities. I've just like, I don't know. I think I've dealt with some shenanigans from some galleries and things, and I don't know. So that's one thing about me. I'm sometimes a shit talker sometimes, but I also think that sometimes shit talking is like necessary because people are on some shenanigans.
Caleb, I'll just say, yeah, you're talking to one of the queen shit talkers here.
I know. We
could empathize. I mean,
yes, I love the candor and the attitude of Jerry and Jerry's creations and Jerry as a creation. So yeah, and I'm also genderqueer. I use she, her pronouns. Most people would probably think that I'm a man when they see me, or maybe not. I don't know. I've had children tell me I always look like I'm dancing. So maybe
ooh.
Yeah, one time I was waiting tables and this little girl drew a picture of me while she was sitting at her table and then gave it to me and said, "You always look like you're dancing." I was like, "I'm having a panic attack." No.
Aww.
I'm kidding. I wasn't. But so yeah, those are some things about me too. I kind of have some like conflict and dissonance between how I feel as like and how I think versus like how I present in the world. And I think that all this and that's why I think at an early age, I attached to the expressionists because I think, and in film too, not just in painting and drawing, but German expressionist film is so queer. And I think that queerness in general really likes to hold hands with expressionism as just like a mode of living. So I'm a very dramatic person. Like you said, I'm expressionistic. I'm over the top. My disorder is in the histrionic, like, category, the sort of like a little too much category. So yes, I'm dramatic, and my work is like a place for me to let those things out a little bit more. And as I've worked with my diagnosis and things like that and medication, my work is also nestled in my treatment for myself.
Caleb, what is it? So we're looking at your work, just Hildy's scrolling through and just saving photos because she's obsessed, and trust me, she's deep in the archive there.
Oh my god,
she keeps going. I can definitely see that you love Schiele. What is it about his work that drew you in at first and what continues to inspire you? Because he's a big hero of mine too, I gotta say.
It's the line work. It's the attitude. Yeah. It's the glamour. It's that point of glamour that was happening at that point. It's like you have Klimt, who is like, you know, his sort of mentor, and he was painting sort of the oligarchy of Vienna at the time, and everything was like the succession building, everything is like gold and over the top. And then Schiele comes in and sort of takes that style and twists it, like literally twists it up and bears it down to just like what looks like not acid free paper, often pencil, watercolor. He did some oil paintings, but I think his drawings are the best.
I've seen Schiele drawings that are, they literally, you could count the number of strokes of the, you know, the pencil or whatever he was using, like on like two hands. Like there's like eight lines and he's creating this form that just blows you away.
I know, he's brilliant.
Really was. That Who else from that era? So you mentioned Klimt. Doesn't sound like he's too much of a hero for you. But what about Kirchner, De Brucke, all those guys too? Or is it really
like I like them a lot. I also like some of the like weirder kind of like I guess I wouldn't necessarily put Otto Dix in with the Expressionists necessarily, because wasn't Otto Dix part of the Weimar situation?
Yeah, there was like a neo-Sacco-like thing they called. We're getting so deep for the art history heads in the audience, yes, which I love. I've been waiting to have this podcast with someone that wants to.
But yeah, I do love all the Expressionists. I like Nold, Emil Nold. I love, there's some good German Expressionists in the Art Institute. I grew up in Detroit, and so I had the DIA collection to sort of worship when I was a kid, and I really loved it. And the Diego Rivera mural atrium was so overpowering to me as a child because it's so huge and beautiful, and there's much going on in terms of like paint and drawing. And so but when I moved to Chicago to come to art school, the Art Institute's collection definitely like blew me away at what they had, things I hadn't seen originals of. I had that like moment in the museum when I first moved here like 20 some years ago, just kind of like taking it all in, having those emotional moments in the museum.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
No, I was going to ask you, because our audience is mainly familiar with like the New York art scene and museum scene, and secondarily the LA thing going on. So could you just give us like an overview of like what's going on in Chicago, how it's changed, where it's at today, some of the major institutions and galleries that are there? I'm just really curious to hear, because it is a major art hub that I don't think gets credit, I think, from a lot of people.
Well, I think the school generates an art culture, but there's not necessarily art capital here. There is people who buy work, but they're not buying necessarily work from Chicago. If you want to show at maybe more major galleries in Chicago, you should move to another city.
Yeah. That's like people that go to RISD, even like a lot of the good schools in California. It's like, sure, like they call them like incubator cities, but then like you're forced to then go live in, you know, urban decay of New York City. Yeah. and do that no matter what, it seems like. Or you know what I mean? Like, or there is that myth that you have to do that, which I very actively am trying to dispel, because I think it's, especially with the internet, like, why do we have to be centrally located anywhere anymore? I feel like that should be bullshit. But nonetheless, I guess people do like hang out, and scenes are real. People do go out, like people drink together, people get dinner, people see each other. And it's important for artists to like see each other, talk to each other, look at each other's work, compare themselves to one another, you know, have rivalries or whatever, make movements together. All these things sort of exist for a reason. And I'm sure Chicago is not the exception to this rule.
Yeah. But one thing that's great about Chicago is that rents are still sort of kind of cheap here. So some like kind of romantic art things can happen on the underground, and the queer DIY like underground scene here was flourishing probably in like 2010 through 2016, maybe. I mean, it still is, but maybe I aged out of some of the events. But I think that that's pretty vital, and that was led here by like artists like Sofia Moreno, Rosé, or Shy Girl. I think that there was some there were moments when some authentic culture was being made and there was a scene for sure, but it just goes unnoticed. A lot of the work.
But
of
do
my
you
friend...
think?
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. I just want to cut you off for 2 seconds because I think maybe it's like a good thing. I was having this like little argument with myself because there's a little scene that lives squarely inside my head. The scene is me and my 2 cats 7 days a week. And then Matt, you know, when he comes home from work, he gets to join the scene. But besides that, there's not really much of a scene that I hang out in, except for when I like go to like major art fairs or things like that to like write about them. I don't hang out in any scene, but yeah. I was thinking about scenes, right? Like I guess because I was also listening to this amazing, there's this new catalog resume that's coming out for Hilma Off Klint, this art historian, mm-hmm. German art historian, taught herself Swedish and went through the like hundreds, if not like, I don't know, maybe even like 1,000 of her like journals to like decipher and decode like all of her thoughts about like gender, actually spirituality, other dimensions, et cetera, et cetera. And scenes was a thing because misogyny was so hardcore in the art world in Europe at the time that literally there was like men that were like advocating for that were like saying like it was toxic for women to even be formally educated and taught how to paint in the academy, that it brought the like general like IQ of the like class down by having women in the academy at the time that she was there. So she and like her very, very small like scene, aka like her, I don't know, 12 friends or 20 friends or whatever, would get together and like make paintings and do seances. And, you know, they were theosophists, some of them, and they had like different like scientific and mixed with like sort of pagan Christian beliefs would like get together, and that was their, you know, scene. And it was like a unseen scene. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, listening to this in the kitchen, hanging out with my scene, aka me and my cats.
Yeah.
and I was like, you know, there's something really fucking unhealthy, or really healthy, excuse me, about not being sort of seen. And I know that we love what's, you know, like nostalgia. Like we look back and people are always like, studio, what is that stupid nightclub?
64.
Studio what? 54. Oh my God. Studio 54. Everybody was there. Blah, blah, blah. Like, who fucking cares? Like, honestly, who gives a fucking shit? Or like, whatever, like the things that people like make nostalgia about, or like Andy Warhol's factory, or like all these like things. What are we really making nostalgia about? Like the things that are really, really, really good, the things that take forever for like people to really uncover the truth about. That's the good shit. And honestly, the really, really good shit, no one ever finds out about. Like, yeah. That's the good stuff.
Yeah, that's the good stuff. I think that people are, I mean, the art world is definitely serving up a lot of like, 1 billion served. Like, it's there's a lot of novelty. There's a lot of overproduced, expensive things. I think sometimes like things can get out of hand, and I like to think about like a Louise Bourgeois drawing, like how that could probably just like blow most of the stuff we're seeing out of the water, because I don't know. I think that there is a careerism in art now. There's a competition, there's a competitiveness to art that I think has gotten kind of unhealthy because there's so much abuse at the level of between the artist and the art world in terms of like the people who are sort of in control of things, or the people with money, I guess you could say, or the people that are buying the work for whatever reason, showing the work. There's just so much, I think, dissonance there. There's some kind of, and I don't think that's new. I think there's always been a sort of strange relationship between the place where the work goes and where the work is made. And
yeah,
they sort of teach you that in art school where they're like, you should hate capitalism and all of this. And this is how Adorno, and this is how, you know, fascism, capitalism, they're all intertwined. And but then you get out of art school and you're like, but wait, this is like the most extreme, like convoluted, backwards way of capitalism system. Like it's unchecked capitalism, or not capitalism, it's I don't know what to call it. It's unchecked commerce that has a lot of intersecting impulses and reasons why people gravitate towards it, I guess. And that seems so foreign, alien to the process of making and art history in terms of looking at it through the work rather than through how it was received or whatever.
Which, like, maybe would have made art history and conversations in art school a lot less fucking boring if people would have been a little more honest about that, you know? Not that, like, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of really fun navel gazing that we did in art school, don't get me wrong. And I loved, like, you know, obsessing about myself endlessly and Chris and just like talking about my childhood trauma ad, you know, infinitum. Yeah. But like, it would have been really interesting to be like, oh, guess what? You're entering exactly what you just said. Like, I couldn't have said it better. So I'm not going to even try. Like, you're entering into a space of like unchecked capitalism. And guess what? Like, the better the liar you are, the more successful you're going to be. So today, after your elocution lessons, we're going to be doing lying lessons. Oh, so buckle up, children. Like, how much more fun would have art school been if it would have been a little more honest?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think just by nature of, and this is like me generalizing a large group of people, but queer artists, trans artists, I think are people making work that is resonating with a kind of vulnerability and authenticity that makes movements post-historic, like post, what is the word, after death, after it's over. And that happens a lot. You see that with artists. Yes. You see work like Greer Langton, who is someone that not a lot of people know about, but she was a trans artist who made these amazing, very rooted in an expressionism, like, sort of dolls, sort of puppets. They're very strange, angular figures. And she was alive in the 80s, like in the 70s and 80s, right, like before the AIDS crisis. And so I think that that's another point of reference too, to think about as we move forward. It's like these artists, there were some artists that kind of broke through, some queer artists before and during the AIDS crisis, David Wanorowicz, people who were getting opportunities, but still like, I mean, homeless, like just kind of like still on the outside of things. And I still think that happens with queer artists, because I think sometimes we make content that's unsettling for people in a kind of pursuit of beauty. Sometimes queer people make grotesque things and we're fine with it. And I think that kind of puts people off sometimes from our aesthetic. So yeah, as far as like unseen scenes, I think that that's been a kind of constant, but now we're seeing this kind of strange result of the visibility over the last maybe 10 years that has really increased for queer and trans people. And it's making the right very nervous, and they are responding with all these terrible legislations. There's like 400 anti-LGBTQ legislations right now hitting, and they're not just coming for queer people, they're mostly coming for trans people right now. trying to take away their rights, access to healthcare. There's a bill being passed right now that says that a transgender person can't be in a bathroom with a minor. But they're also coming for interracial marriage. A bill just was passed in Tennessee that makes it clerks able to deny marriage license based on same-sex marriage, interfaith, and interracial. So these people are crazy, basically.
Yeah. I mean, wait. Before we broach the entire craziness of the world, I want to go back to something that you started talking about, which is something that you and I have DM'd a little bit about in the past, which is just what it has been like for you, or what you feel your reception has been as a queer identifying. I don't know if you would say you identify, but you don't identify it as a trans artist, do you? Or you just say queer?
I say genderqueer or trans, or genderqueer, okay, or queer. So not trans necessarily. I personally haven't done anything to transition besides mm-hmm. my own levels of whatever that make me, like, I don't know, able to embody the feminine in certain ways through movement, through things that people have targeted me for my whole life as feminine. You move like a girl, you talk like a girl, are you a boy or a girl? But I haven't medically done anything to change my body or my thinking. I am not on hormones or anything, which is fine. People call themselves trans who are not on hormones, who haven't had any surgery. I feel a certain way about calling myself a trans woman because of those things. I don't know.
Okay, so as somebody who identifies as a gender queer artist, how do you feel your reception has been, especially as you said, in the last, you know, couple of years? There's been this, you know, Matt always uses this term in a myriad of ways, the sort of, what do you say, like the lifting of the kimono, or the
opening of the
kimono. But I feel like it, as I've watched it happen, it's been to the detriment, but in many ways, and in some ways, it's been wonderful for so many people, because there's been many instances where people are like, great, now we can just all move on and agree that, like, we, like, love you no matter what. This never really mattered anyway. We're happy you are who you are, you know, moving upwards and onwards. And then there's other people who are, you know, deeply uncomfortable, filled with, I don't even have words for it, really, because I'm not sure how to explain the places that they're in, but they express, you know, hatred, they enact physical violence towards trans women and men, they threaten it, they, you know, I mean, it's just, it has not been good. So there's been, and then there's been anti-trans legislation on the table. It just feels like two steps forward, one step back. And I feel like, you know, my best friend, who definitely identifies as a gay man, but has been playing with, you know, dressing up as an artist and has always been very fluid, let's just say, ever mm-hmm. since I've known him. Like, because he's my family member, basically, mm-hmm. at this point, after knowing him for like 15 years. I have a very, very, very hard time even fathoming that this isn't still an issue. To me, it would be like saying, like, oh, we're talking about whether or not dentistry should be legal in America again. Like, it's very, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's very hard for me. And so obviously the only thing I can do is A, ask you what it has been like for you as a person and what it has been for you, like for you as an artist and a person in the art world, because I'm very curious with all the virtue signaling that goes on in the art world. If you feel like the virtue signal matches the if the actions, you know, line up behind all the, you know, we support trans artists talk that goes on.
I don't think so at all. I think a lot of people, not everyone for sure, there are people who have a way of seeing other human beings as human beings without, you know, wanting to dehumanize them by taking away their rights. I think there's plenty of people like that. But for the people who are transphobic, I think transphobia is built into the web of our society through white supremacy and capitalism. I think it benefits society to have two clear genders and gender roles. I think it benefits men, like a male-run society. It benefits a male-run society, not that that's good for society or that's how I envision society. I think that it intersects so much desire. It intersects, like, I mean, the art world, the trans world probably intersects the art world in ways that have nothing to do with art shows a lot. I think that there are a lot of men who are married to cis women who like to get away from the script they've written from themselves and sleep with trans women. And I'm sure there's tons of men in the art world that do that. And I think that this sort of gatekeeping to minorities and the virtue signaling that's happening, the sort of like, you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out, like this kind of like who it is opening up so many of the problems, it's dovetailing so many of the problems of just any sort of white cis het centered system in general. It's going to be abusive. We just know that. We have so many examples of it. I don't think I need to like really cite any. But so yeah, it has been. Even in grad school, I got told in my first crit that I was wanted to be worshipped and that I was moving my hands around so much when I talked. And
I really want to see you dancing, Caleb. you must be dancing all the time.
I must be. I must just be just like flowing around in a caftan with a Cleopatra eye or something. Because I mean, I am usually at home, honestly. Like I have a lot of blush on right now. But yeah, and I think I had an experience with my friend here at a major gallery, Western Exhibitions. My friend, she's a transgender woman. She prices her work according to her own life. She's like my age. And it was this instance where there was another artist who had drawn a picture of a brown trans woman who had taken her own life. And that was on display. And it had a very high price because the artist is more well known, has been in the Whitney. Whereas Sophia's work, the mantle and her prices were too high. The man that runs it, Scott, and the night of the opening, he lowered all her prices without telling her.
Really?
Whoa.
And told her that she can't ask those prices because she's not been in the Whitney or she's not been, but he doesn't know what she's done. It was very, so we went in the next weekend and took down her whole show and just left his gallery empty.
Good.
Wow.
He was a total asshole and it was totally a power play and it was totally just like this inconsideration of Sophia as an artist with integrity that has a huge career behind her, who's curated shows in Mexico City with myself and artists now who like Kiwi. I don't know if anyone knows her. She's an amazing performance artist that's working mostly in New York, but all over the world, actually. Sophia curated her and I into a show like in Mexico City years ago in like 2016. And like, it's awesome. Like, these people don't know what she's done. So I don't know. It just becomes this thing where there's a measure still in the art world. And that measure is still these sort of white Euro-American kind of standards of like what is success in the art world and what allowed you to, but also people didn't make the connection that in the next gallery there is this drawing of a brown trans woman that is selling for like I think it was 20,000, I don't know. But like Sophia, a living trans woman artist can't ask for her own prices. It's just the whole thing becomes, I don't know. I just don't get it. It's so abusive.
Yeah, it doesn't have Caleb, to be I was going like to say, it, to me, it feels like, and this is not a question coming from this, but rather just something for all of us to think about. Like, it feels like the art world, the mainstream, the core central art world, it has found in the last few years an impetus to show works by historically marginalized, unseen artists, but only a certain group of them, right?
Yeah.
It's like they're very selective. And I think we talked about this with Simkowitz the other day. It's like they're very curatorial and selective of the overlooked minority type artists of the past. And they have to be painting in a certain style. You know what I mean? It's like it's a very select thing. And they have blind spots towards other groups. And it's very interesting to see that. And Hildy Jerry mentioned it, like this virtue signaling, talking the talk, but walking the walk. It's always like, oh, well, maybe tomorrow. Maybe our collectors are not ready. Maybe we're not, we can't do certain prices. It's fascinating to me. It seems like there's a disconnect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was in a situation a couple years ago, but not, yeah, 2 years ago, two years ago, 3 years ago, where I was asked to organize a group of artists together for something. And the person that was asking me to curate this show, they asked me to go after all of these really big, really popular, hot contemporary female artists. And I said to them, I will only do this if you put my friend, who you've never heard of, but I'm showing you the work and I'm telling you is just as good as all these quote unquote hot, cool, whatever artists, but who happens to be trans and therefore does not get any of the opportunities that all of these hot, young, contemporary female artists get. And I will not use any of my connections. I will not put this show together. I will not make a single phone call for you. I will not use any of my clout. I will not do any of this for you unless, you know, you allow me to put this trans artist in the show. And this guy who was, you know, a family man, you know, of straight family man, hemmed and hawed over the prospect. And first of all, he acted to me like he'd never heard of a trans artist ever in his fucking life, ever. And I'm like, bro, it's 20. I can't remember like what year, like it's 2021 or like whatever. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, you've heard of a trans artist. And he kept saying things to me like, what do I even say? Like, him, her, they, they're what, they, like being so fucking dismissive and rude. And then he kept saying like, I just, how am I going to explain this to my collectors? How am I going to explain this to my collectors? This is going to make them uncomfortable. This is going to make them uncomfortable. And at the end of the day, you know what? Let me tell you, that show never fucking happened for a reason. And yeah. I had I just had to be extremely principled in this situation. And what broke my heart and made me really sad about it was that in advance to me organizing this potential exhibition, I had called my friend and said, hey, I'm putting together the show. Would you like to be in the show? And because the pandemic had been so financially hard on this person, this show had the potential to like really be financially helpful and impactful. And the guilt that I've had to call that person and walk back that show, and also not, I could not tell them. They don't know to this day why that show never happened. I wasn't going to tell them that it was because we were dealing with somebody who was just such an intolerant bastard that I couldn't do that to them after all they'd been through themselves to transition and what that had meant for their entire life and for their mental health and for their entire art practice and for what that meant for them financially and what that meant for them socially and what that meant for every single part of their life. For me to like pick up the phone and be like, hey, I'm sorry, but you lost that opportunity because somebody was bigoted. I didn't have the heart to do that. So I just called and I kind of made up like a white lie, like, oh, you know, we just, you know, the show got put on ice for a while. It might happen in the future, but it's just not going to happen now. Because I couldn't break that. I couldn't break their heart any further. You know what I mean? It was just I couldn't add insult to further fucking injury. It was too much. And I'm too sensitive as a, you know, just even my best friend having watched what he's gone through as a gay man and some of the things I've heard people say to him as an artist and just as a person, I'm just too sensitive and I'm too protective to you guys get enough, or you know what I mean? It's like, you guys get enough. I just didn't need to be the bearer of one more piece of bad news, you know?
Yeah, but you know, I'm glad you shared that story because I think on some levels or on most levels, people in my community know these conversations happen. We know they have to happen because we know from polls, we know from this legislation, we know from the legislation that's being passed. People don't like trans people a lot of the time. I think I saw a statistic like 78% of the population in the States agrees that children should be banned from any gender affirming care, even if, yeah, and also believe that kids shouldn't be seeing or learning things about LGBTQ history as an early age because it's sexualizing them somehow. But I mean, like I think about like JonBenet or someone like that. I mean, that was some serious,
right,
fucked up example of what really is grooming and sexualizing a child to the point where she gets murdered. So I don't know. I also just think that I think you're absolutely right. Trans people experience a lot of adversity, violence, anxiety, and mental health issues because of those things. With all this legislation that's being passed, it really does chip away at you. It makes you worry about your friends. It makes you worry about the future, where we're headed as a country. If this can happen so quickly and the government isn't doing anything about it, then anything we can imagine can happen so quickly. They were literally stripping people of their rights, parental rights. There's a law trying to be passed that if you get gender affirming care for your child, they can take your child away.
Wait, what's gender affirming care?
Gender affirming care is anything that affirms a person's gender, be it taking hormones or puberty blockers. You know, last night I saw this young girl named Jazz. She's like at Stanford now, but she was on.
Yeah,
she's
famous. She's very famous. I know Jazz is. Yeah.
She has a death threat on her right now. Just this person.
Great.
So like she's terrified. And there's so much violence that happens against trans women. And people don't see the connection between this violence and the behavior that people have all around, just mocking trans people or just in general treating trans people like they're not human beings, that they don't deserve to express themselves. What a boring society. Like, that's what that guy could have told his collectors. This person is expressing themselves authentically. Don't you want, why don't you prefer an artist like that rather than, you know, someone who's reading a script?
No, they want to just sell. They want to sell. It's like about the market. That's the whole thing.
It is, yeah.
It's like if the sharks feel like they can make a buck on a certain type of artwork or movement or, you know, identity, they'll run with it. They'll run with it. It's really like that. Yeah. It's like goes back to your initial point about that kind of fucked up capitalism. That's the world that the art world plays in. And they don't prepare people for that when they're in art school about to join it. But that's really the incentive. I mean, it's like, I think that's what happened in the last few years with artists of color. It's like they saw that these markets were forming where you can get $1 million auction record. And so every gallery rushed for it. And it's like, but again, they did it very, very strategically and in a tight way. Yeah.
Yeah. And didn't change anything about the way they behave in order to, like, you know, like you have to, when you bring people in that are different than you normally do, you have to realize that they are going to bring their authentic selves. And if you can't, if that makes you uncomfortable, that's something that you have to deal with, but you shouldn't like be toxic. You shouldn't respond from your phobias or you shouldn't be disrespectful. You shouldn't, I don't know. I think there's so many things that happen at the level of interaction with the artists in the gallery that just multiply when you start dealing with.
Even the institutions, you know what I noticed? This just like occurred to me while you're speaking. So whenever I've noticed that I do see any place that I do notice genderqueer or trans artists being able to take up space or have space, you know where it is? This bothers me. I just realized it. It's like they get to DJ at MoMA PS1.
Exactly. They always make us nightlife stuff. They always do this. Okay, yes.
Right? Like,
no, it's totally true. It's
what the fuck?
True.
Or like, yeah, they get to throw a party or they get to like, I don't know, like, yeah, do the drinks at, yeah, I guess that all goes under nightlife or whatever, or do like some kind of a drag show or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much more, which actually, I mean, this conversation is wild because we've gone in a million directions, and I actually want to kind of, not because I'm trying to limit the conversation, but I just love your artwork so much that I want to go back to your work just a little bit for a second. You have a death series where you were painting death for a while. Do you remember that? Because you have many bodies of work.
Yeah, I do. It was just like black acrylic on big paper.
Those are amazing. Those are, I'm very curious about those. I'm just going to kind of like run through some of the things that, but then you have these works. They're all together. They're called Interdimensional Femmes, Movement to Find Plant Spirits. I'm like transfixed by those. I think they're so beautiful.
Okay, why don't you start with like just talking us through some of those and your thought process and where you were at. I'm very curious because they are really interesting. And we'll share links for everything on the pod so people can see what we're talking about as they listen.
Yeah, okay. Well, the death paintings were, you know, the Seventh Seal cover. I'm like into film. So the Death series came kind of from like emulating thinking about death in that way in this very kind of cliche like hooded figure. But I also wanted to take the time to create this void, this sense or a portal with the fabric of the sort of cloak. So it's this like cloaked figure that sometimes has like a gestural face that's made with sometimes paint, sometimes makeup. When I paint a lot with faces, I do like monoprints. So sometimes I'll press paper against it to like remove some of the material. But I was really interested in just like making these like large dark images that were matte, that would sort of encompass a whole figure, but also be like a monochrome almost, and kind of like signaling this sort of monochrome as like historically as this sort of sublime kind of getting at the sublime through a field of color. I wanted to sort of make that analogy too. I literally am always trying to make a monochrome, by the way, but I never can.
Caleb, a lot of your work has this motif of like this, it looks like a dot or a moon or something like that. It seems like it spans across the different series.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like those are just like, they come from like watching too much Sailor Moon and like the Negaverse as a kid. Like they're planetary, they're emotive orbs. They're like, I don't know, they can represent different things. Sometimes they lay on the body and have a star on them. A lot of the interdimensional femmes is like one sort of concrete series that changes sort of. And there's always like a femme. The femmes are sort of, they're not human, but they're humanoid. And it's just sort of a catch-all for my interests. And I sort of, the femmes are me, really. I mean, I am the interdimensional femmes. And like things that are interesting to me, how can I intersect these interests that are very simple? Like I'm interested in these flowers, and I'm interested in this Italian witchcraft called pharmakeia. Okay. And how can I intersect those things? And because things will resonate with me for a reason that often ties back into my work, because I'm always looking for things to incorporate into my work. So the interdimensional femmes change, and the titles sort of change. And the pastel drawings, which are also interdimensional femmes, came about because a friend of mine was having a hard time and they wanted to come over and work on a drawing. So I set them up a big board to draw on in my studio, and they made a drawing. We just like talked about stuff, and then they felt a lot better afterwards. Anyways, they gifted me some pastels as a present to say thank you. And I didn't have any other art supplies at the time. So, I mean, I started making these pastel drawings out of like taped together paper that I was getting it's like kids' art paper. So it was really cheap. And those drawings are actually in North Carolina at a gallery called Tiger Tiger in Asheville. They really liked those drawings. So they have those.
So amazing. And then there's another interdimensional femme on an unfamiliar plane, lost and wounded in an obsidian manzanita forest.
Oh, that one? I know that one, yes.
Oh, I love it. I love them. They're the drama. Talk about a fucking dramatic title. If there was ever a dramatic, you know.
I know.
It's a very dramatic title.
I know. I used to never know what to title my stuff. And then I just started just like being like kind of honest about where my head was. And everything's very like, you know, science fiction involved. I'm a huge fan of science fiction, which is very common for young, like for queer kids to get into science fiction at an early age. So yeah, there's always that desire too, to sort of speculate through my drawings there's this idea, it's a little dated, like queer utopia, these like queer utopian ideas, but it's neither, that femmes are neither in a dystopian or utopian world. They're sort of in all dimensions and can go really anywhere. Not to say that they don't have pitfalls or things like that, but or that they don't have enemies. Yeah. Sorry, I'm rambling at this point.
No, it's okay. And then, wait, a few more. And then there's this thing that I like about your Instagram, which is way more fun than your website. No offense.
I know. I need to update my website.
I just tell everybody, go to your Instagram, because your Instagram is like, it's just like, it's a blast. Like, everybody should just go to Caleb's Instagram right now. What I like about your Instagram is that, and again, this is part of the whole "she can sit with us" thing, is that, and Charles, my best friend, would be so thrilled that you and I got to meet and I got to interview you, is that really, like, we never knew, like, what was you, what was a performance, and like, what was, like, with zero context, with absolutely zero context about anything, because I follow so many different kinds of artists on my private Instagram, which, when I say I follow different kinds of artists, I don't follow, like, just art world, capital A, capital W, art world artists. I follow, like, just if I like it and I feel, like, spiritually drawn to it, which is, like, something that, you know, I feel like I exist, you know, we all do. We all exist on a multidimensional plane, but, like, I'm in tune, I feel, with some of the other planes that I feel like I exist on. Like, I tap the follow button. So, like, I never really know who or what I'm following. And so we never knew very much about you. We just knew, like, we loved your work. But there's this really funny thing about your Instagram, which is, what is performance? Who are you in all of this? And then, like, what is serious? What is not serious? What is seriously funny? What is seriously not funny? I mean, like, I love this. I love the complexity of it, because I think there's a lot of people with these ultra curated, annoying Instagram accounts where you're like, oh my God, like, can you please fart or do something imperfect? For the love of God, like, just stop pretending to be perfect. You're not perfect. Stop curating this. You're an artist, for God's sakes. And anyway, all that to say, you have these self-portraits that are, you know, there's almost like a Cindy Sherman quality to them. But then there's kind of like this Paul McCartney quality to them, where sort of scary sometimes, not all the time, but then they're like high glam sometimes too, like, and sometimes also high, like, angelic, like your drawings. And then you mix them where there's sort of almost like mock-ups for some of the drawings that you do. And I've realized that, and then what's even, like, what makes that even better is I zigzag through and I'm like, there's this drawing that you have that I love called Love from Behind Crossdresser Blues. Do you know yeah. which one that is? Okay. So I feel like this is TFI.
It's fine.
In my family, we have this thing. It's a legend. It's called the Lynn family extended back. And it's just a very nice way of saying we all have profoundly flat asses. Like, no matter like Like, no matter what we do, no matter how many squats we do, like, no matter what bands, no movements, what class we sign up for, we all have flat, weird asses. It's just a thing, you know? And, like, bless us and our weird Northern European asses. And, like, I saw the photo that originated, and then I saw the subsequent drawings that came from the photo and then your drawing. And I was like, I can so relate to this photo just because I'm like, there's just been so many times where I'm like, maybe if I just move like this and I move the camera like this. And I arch my back just like that, I can sort of make it look kind of like I have an ass, but I can't because I'm cursed with the Lynn family extended back. And so I absolutely fucking love this drawing, and I like the photos that they come from, like, they're fucking great. They're really great. And needless to say, I mean, I don't think you should change a thing about your Instagram. I think it's wonderful. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, love from behind, Crossdresser Blues is very real. It just comes from my life. You know, it's a very real thing. The Crossdresser Blues.
But I mean, also, can we just talk about, like, the dresser blues? Like,
the what?
Just the can we talk about the full length mirror blues? Can we do a series called the full length mirror blues? Because those can be kind of depressing mirror blues, too. Yes.
Absolutely.
So, What do you have going on? When are you coming to visit us on the East Coast? When can I host you at my palatial estate? What is there anything coming up for you as we spring into spring, as they say, and as things as warm up in Chicago?
Well, I just had a group show go down in Chicago, and that's over, and then I have a show coming up at this DIY trans run space in Boston called Shoebones. And then Shoebones. And then
send us the link so that we can link to it.
Okay. And then there's a gallery, and it's called Also Gallery in LA. And it's like another situation where it's kind of like a DIY, not a DIY space, I'd say, but it's like an artist run space. So those are two things coming up. Yeah. And I'm in a band called Barbiefoot, and we play around town, and I always look forward to that because it's so different and fun to make music with my friends, because we just like make like soundscapes and stuff. It's not like there's only one seriously trained musician in the group. The rest of us are just hacking our ways with drum machines and stuff.
What's your instrument? Or are you a vocalist? I imagine that you're like the opera singer of the group.
I can't sing at all. I have a terrible singing voice. I wish I could sing, but I use the drum machine, which I've gotten pretty good at using. It's very intuitive, drum machine, so they're fun. And then I have an Ebo. Do you know what an Ebo is?
No.
It's like a little device that you lay over guitar strings, and it creates an electric field that vibrates the strings so that you can play the guitar sort of like you would have cello or a violin, where there's like a sustained sound, and then you're changing it by, because I can play the guitar.
Guys, we will link everything Caleb's got going on in the bio. Please,
yes,
please go check it out
and check out Caleb's epic, prolific, ever-changing, expanding, amazing artwork. And seriously, you have an open invitation anytime you head out east. We would love to have you and host you. So
that would be so awesome. Thank you so much
to meet you.
This was great. Yes. I would love to meet you as well, both of you.
All right, thank you for coming on.
And thank all of you for listening in to this week's episode of Art Smack. That was Jerry and I's conversation with Caleb Yono. Links are all in the description. As always, head over to gagosian.com and become a premium subscriber and follow Jerry. All right, guys, this has been real. See you later. See you on the internet.